Hello and welcome back to Even More News, the first and only news podcast. My name's Katie Stoll.
Yep. Hi.
And you are
Cody Johnston.
Hello. We did it. We got there. Real quick, gotta wish everybody a real nice national high five day. Also, RIP Bernie Madoff.
Ooh.
High five.
High five.
Virtual high fives.
High five that guy.
Bye.
I guess. Whatever.
I've got nothing to say.
I have no, like, it's, yeah, he's dead. And people had 4 hours where they're like, oh, here's my thought about Bernie Madoff. And then no one ever talked about it again.
I mean, it barely broke the news cycle. Speaking of which, thanks to ExpressVPN for supporting Even More News. Stop handing over your personal data to the big tech monopoly that mines your activity and sells your information. Go to expressvpn.com/morenews and you can get an extra 3 months free. Hi, Cody.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, how's it going?
Hey. Hi. It's fine.
We got a little bit of a different episode today. It's just Cody and myself up top, but we will be joined later in the episode, in the second half, with my friend Chris Rivas. I've been wanting to have Chris on for a long time, but I was never quite sure when the right opportunity was. And I was intending just to interview him about some of the work he's doing, but he's pretty fired up about Dante Wright, as are we. So we thought it would be a really good time to have him discuss what's been going on. So we will be getting to that in the second half of the episode. To start, though, Cody.
Hi.
Why don't you talk to us about Afghanistan?
Oh, our dancing partner?
Our dancing partner, Afghanistan.
Yeah. The dance might end soon. Oh, no. Yeah, word is that Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., the president.
President.
Is going to get the troops out of here, out of there. We're leaving. Despite all the other times that it has been said that we are going to leave, like him when he was the vice president, like 2014 or something like that. This is a slight continuation of Trump made a deal with the Taliban last year and everyone was really mad. NATO is concerned and all these things. This is sort of an extension of that. They will not be meeting the May 1st timeline, but will be happening allegedly, and the usual suspects are out and saying how bad of an idea this is. You know, the Bill Crystals, I assume David Froom and all
now,
those
why
freaks.
why so Donald Trump negotiated this May deadline. Presumably did nothing to advance us towards hitting that deadline.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Like, there's a lot of, there's a lot of posturing from Trump in terms of being like, I'm anti-war and so on. He was not. Amped up drone strikes, all these sort of things.
He incited a riot. Let's be real.
Also that, you know, and there are people like, oh, look at this statement from Nancy Pelosi when she was like, Trump's, it's a bad thing to do. And now that Biden's doing it, she's like, I support this. And there is an element of that, I think, in a lot of things that have happened over the past like 4 or 5 years where like, yeah, it's our guy and he's saying it a little differently. And so we're cool with it now. Obviously, it is slightly different because NATO wasn't on board. And there was like no plan. Trump is not a plan man. He just says like, let's do the thing. But also at the same time, like, how long are we going to be looking for that fucking plan? Even now there are people like, I don't know, mounting concerns on like whether or not now's the time. And I don't want to, deny a lot of those voices there. You know, there's calls from, people in the UN and women in Afghanistan who are like, well, this will set us back if you leave.
It's really tricky removing. This is not in defense of us staying, but to do it wrong is bad. We have a responsibility to be responsible
Yeah, I mean, it's it was pretty irresponsible to like get involved in that.
Yeah, it is. Without question. There's nothing responsible about what's been going on.
And how that started and how it continued and just the conversation, like what is the right way? Because there's all this concern of like, well, should we do it now? If we leave now, if not now, when? It's the same old song. You know, the Taliban released their statements. We won the war. We've won the war and America lost.
Yeah. And threats about if we don't honor the original deadline. What casualties? But also.
Well, it's just war talk. And like, okay, are you like taunting? So like, well, then we'll stay. If you think you won, then we'll stay to prove you wrong.
It's an abusive relationship that nobody can leave.
Yeah. I mean, it's been 20. Almost 20 years.
We're common law married at this point.
Yes, we are. We are common law married. It's a very long and exhausting dance. And it's just the kind of thing that we'll see even if they do it. They'll be like, okay, we're removing most, but we'll leave this security, like this and this and this, is what will probably happen.
But they, as stated, is full withdrawal by September 11th.
Allegedly.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Like, that's, yeah. But, you know, we'll see. Interesting side note to this, a little tidbit. Do you remember that story about the Russian bounties on soldiers in Afghanistan?
Yes, I do remember that story.
It's likely not true. I think we probably mentioned that, we'll see when it broke originally. But yeah, it's likely not true. The Biden administration has low to moderate confidence in it.
Refresh us on that story.
Russia had put bounties on U.S. soldiers. Yeah. But according to the officials on Thursday's call, the reporting about the alleged bounties came from detainee reporting, raising the specter that someone told their U.S. aligned Afghan jailers what they thought was necessary to get out of a cage. Specifically, the official cited information and evidence of connections to criminal agents in Afghanistan and elements of the Russian government as sources for the intelligence community's assessment. Without additional corroboration, such reporting is notoriously unreliable. Detainee reporting from a man known as Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, extracted from torture, infamously and bogusly fueled a Bush administration claim used to invade Iraq about Saddam Hussein training al-Qaeda to make poison gas, and so on. There seems to be no causative link to any actual U.S. deaths. One retired diplomat suspected someone leaked this to slow down the troop withdrawal. So that's just a side note, unrelated or potentially related to the attempts to leave the fucking war.
It's certainly related enough that this is the section where you would mention it.
This is the section.
There's not another point in this episode where that would be an appropriate story to bring up.
Yeah, I'm not going to bring it up elsewhere.
So I think my official opinion is good job, Cody.
Yeah, I should have brought it up then. And yeah, we will see. It's also interesting. They have low to moderate confidence, the Biden administration, but also they cited that as one of the reasons for the sanctions on Russia.
Okay.
So I don't know.
That's still cited as one of the, okay.
I mean, the sanctions will be among what President Biden's aides say are seen and unseen steps in response to the hacking, known as SolarWinds, to the CIA's assessment that Russia offered to pay bounties to militants in Afghanistan.
That seems bad, then.
And so, yeah, I don't know, it seems a little...
This also seems like a story that I would really want an expert to come in and, like...
Good thing I'm here.
See, you are.
The thing about Afghanistan is it's elsewhere on the globe. And
that
other
is
people
true.
Live there, and that's I could spell it if I had to. It starts with an A. So you're welcome.
I'm going to talk real quick. Sorry for the hard pivot. I'm going to talk real quick about Johnson & Johnson vaccines mm-hmm. being paused, because this was making all of Twitter yesterday mm-hmm. Talking about this story. Janssen. The one-shot vaccine from Johnson & Johnson. Why would you name it Janssen? I'm sorry. Mm. Just call it Johnson. If you're going to do something, now it's Janssen from Johnson & Johnson. It's confusing for me. Regardless, that's not the point. They've halted. They've okay. halted distribution of that vaccine just for a little bit. Mm-hmm. They're just going to see. They're gathering data. Everyone was upset. You either were angry that this pause happened or like... It's a big deal. It needs to happen. Here are my thoughts. All right. So I believe it's 6 people out of 7 million have developed blood clots. All of them were women. one of those people have died. And a lot of people were comparing that statistic, including myself, to that of birth control, which is 1 in 1,000 women are likely to have a blood clot when they're on birth control. I share that as perspective because I think a lot of people were kind of freaking out, you know, especially if you got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you know, and worrying about that. The truth is that your odds, if you have Johnson & Johnson, if you will be receiving Johnson & Johnson, the odds of you getting a blood clot.
Receiving Johnson. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, Johnson. Janssen. Sorry, I'm sorry. Sorry the sorry. Janssen. Sorry, Johnston. I meant Janssen from Johnson & Johnson. Is this clear?
No,
it's I'm clear. Following. Everybody's following. It's very unlikely that you will have get a blood clot. This is out of an abundance of caution. They are getting all the other data. They're putting the call out from medical providers to share their client data because right now we don't actually know. They're going to broaden the scope. Maybe it doesn't just affect women. Maybe there are people who have had strokes or they thought that they had a stroke and in fact it was a blood clot related to this. So hopefully it will resume sooner than later. Whether or not, I mean, I'm not a science guy, so or girl, you know, I can't speak to this process. Seems like it would be a PR nightmare if we didn't pause it and it turned out that there was a problem, especially since when Trump was still in office, a lot of us talked about how we didn't want a rushed vaccine that might have a bunch of bad side effects. So I do think that probably this is the best call. However, it does cause a lot of problems in terms of our vaccine rollout, public confidence in the vaccine, and internationally. You know, it's causing all sorts of problems in distribution internationally, especially, you know, South Africa had to pause their AstraZeneca and now they have to pause this. It's really hard for, you know, the one shot Janssen is necessary for a lot of rural communities where they don't have, you know, freezers available to store the other vaccines. And, you know, there are a lot of people that are pretty vaccine hesitant that might
already,
be swayed. So it is complicated. It does suck.
Or maybe it'll help and they'll be like, oh, now that they've pulled it and they're, you know, they got more data. Now I'm more confident that it's good now.
Maybe.
Right?
I don't know if that's how things work. In theory, it should work that way, but
there's terrible at messaging. They're not good at it.
We're so polarized. We have to take an extreme position on things. And when I see this data, it's like, yeah, maybe it's worthwhile to pause this. I don't love that it might be very bad for us in the long term in terms of this rollout. But we watch commercials all the time. Flonase. I shouldn't say Flonase because that's an actual product, but may cause seizures, depression, dehydration, and death.
May cause death.
We're inundated with this all the time, but then we see 6 people have had blood clots. Anyway, I guess this isn't a compelling point, but it is a point.
It is a point, and it is compelling in ways, and I mean, it's important.
Don't humor me. I'm exhausted.
Oh.
I'm not my best today.
No, you're always at your best.
My personal best, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Everything's a mess.
I know. I feel like it's a good time to take a break.
I couldn't agree with you more.
You couldn't agree with me completely more.
I couldn't completely more agree with you. Complete.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. You're going to hear an ad. We're going to drink some caffeine and then we're going to talk to Chris Rivas about
good news.
No.
Hi. Does it make sense that the same company who controls half of online retail also passively eavesdrops on your private conversations at home? From a fiscal perspective, you bet. But what about the idea that a single company controls 90% of internet searches, runs your email service, and gets to track everything you do on your smartphone? Again, from a fiscal, sort of monopolistic perspective, makes perfect sense. But it also doesn't sound good, right? Then maybe it's time to put a layer of protection between your completely normal, online activity, and these tech juggernauts, and that's why I use ExpressVPN. Virtually every site you visit, video you watch, or message you send gets tracked and data mined, especially if you're what one might call extremely online. But when you run ExpressVPN on your device, the software hides your IP address, something big tech can use to personally identify you. So ExpressVPN makes your activity harder to trace and sell to advertisers. What I like most about ExpressVPN is how easy it is to use, because instructions are for suckers. Just download the app on your phone or computer, tap one button, and you're protected. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your internet data to keep you safe from hackers and eavesdroppers on your network. So, note to hackers, cut it out there, will ya? Stop handing over your personal data to the big tech monopoly that mines your activity and sells your information. Protect yourself with a VPN we trust to keep us safe online. Visit vpn.com/morenews. That's E-X-P-R-E-S-S. vpn.com/morenews to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/morenews right now to learn more.
All right. Well, today, as I mentioned up top, we are joined by my dear friend, writer, storyteller, actor, Christopher Rivas.
What's up, y'all?
Hi. Do you prefer, I call you Chris, do you prefer professionally to be identified as Chris or Christopher?
I do not have a preference.
Okay.
I think that upsets some people, but I'm really, both work for me.
They expect you to like have a really firm stance on your name. You're like, whatever you feel like calling me.
Yeah, you know, and I know those people. Like, I know an Alexandra who's like, I'm not an Alex, and I will not speak to you if you call me Alex. Like, my name is Alexandra, and I get that, but I will speak to you if you call me Chris.
I'm like a dog almost, where, you know, I've got that two-syllable E name, KT. Cody, you're similar. I'll respond to anything that's in the, you know, vicinity of Katie.
Yeah, close enough, right?
These are all thrilling topics to get started with. No, I've
well, that's what they're talking about in the news, right?
Oh, that's the only thing anyone's talking about. No, I've been wanting to have you on for quite a long time, Chris. I'm just always so blown away by your eloquence and by your perspective. I leave our conversations as friends feeling better, feeling calmer. And so I really want to share that with our audience. This week is a heavy news week. So I'm really grateful to have you here to share your perspective on what's going on. The heavy news of which I refer is, of course, the brutal murder of Dante Wright. It is also to the murder of 13-year-old Adam Toledo, who was fatally shot by police in Chicago in March. Police originally claimed that Adam was holding a gun. However, video was released today that shows he was not, in fact, holding a gun, at least not at the time of his shooting. He might have had one earlier, but he dropped it. In the video, he very clearly is turning around with his hands up, and then he gets shot. I'm feeling really heavy. I've been dreading is the wrong word. Dreading this. I'll just start by saying I feel sick, and it almost feels pointless to even say that, except that we have to keep saying it. Otherwise, what are we doing here? How are you guys feeling today? Before I get into the details, I just want to check in.
Cody?
About the news or in general? Because
I'll say about the news.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's always, right? Just, it's sad. I watched the body cam footage. I don't really recommend it to other people.
It's really hard.
And I try to not like retweet anything to like spread the actual video. But it's the kind of thing, you know, you have this one case and then like the next day there's another and then the next day. And it's always seems to be that the police lie about what happened. And then, you know, when enough time has passed, then it bubbles over again. And there's this story from a couple years ago out of Baltimore. Bunch of Baltimore cops revealed in a trial they would carry around toy guns to plant on people that they accidentally shot. And I don't know. I'm just rambling now about like.
Yeah. No, I understand. It's hard. I'll also say, I mean, I'm gutted by that video. I'm glad I'm watched, and I don't encourage other people to watch either. If you don't think that you're up for that, I'm reminded of the fact that these stories rarely break the surface of the news unless there is a video involved. Adam Toledo lost his life weeks ago.
Well, that's the classic thing you always hear, which is this isn't something unknown. It might be unknown to certain people. Like, it's always been happening. It's always been happening. I don't want to believe. Yeah. You know, you asked for a check-in, and I was like, God, with the onslaught of it and,
yeah,
and the consistency of it, it just challenges hope. Like, it, you know, as a body of color, it just challenges hope. It, like, it challenges whether things actually do change or can change. And, you know, not to, I don't need to steer this conversation, but, you know, I don't think,
please,
any
go
change,
ahead.
You know, I don't think any change can actually occur. And I don't think I'm far off in this, you know, unless a conviction is made.
In Derek Chauvin's trial.
Yeah. Like, until the first domino falls, they have no reason to think differently.
Yeah, that's definitely, yeah, a huge part of that first step. It's one of those things where, because cops, like, not every cop gets away with this kind of thing. Every once in a while, someone doesn't. And it feels like it's just going to continue. I guess this is just me agreeing that, like, challenges hope. Like, even if that happens, that, okay, well, we got rid of the bad apple. And, like, it's just going to be a series of these sort of incidents where the quote bad apple is taken care of, but nothing under the surface is actually addressed, because that's the running narrative is that that's the case.
Yeah.
Though I think you're also, like, sort of referring to, like, the idea that if consequences are actually had, then fewer cops will be inclined to react and behave in that way. Which I guess is the hope, right?
Yeah, and react is a good word, right? Because, like, which is way above my pay grade, but, you know, the training of officers are they're so react, they react. And, I, you know, let's be honest, I would imagine that I could be, you know, I could pass the test, I think. You know,
mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
I think the physical and mental requirements are not terribly, you know, of a certain standard that, you know, it's the elite of the elite. And
yeah,
I
we don't have
that,
gladiators yeah. out there.
And I imagine that has something to do with it, you know, that fear 100%. Takes over. And if we're not training people how to deal with their fear, they become so reactive.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're also, they are trained to, because it is reactive, but it also, like, you know, there are training programs for cops that kind of teach them to do things like this,
yeah.
To shoot first, to be, like, the hero in their mind. They're the sort of, like, angel warriors going out. Which is why you'll see, like, you know, like with Breonna Taylor, situations like that, where they just, like, it is a reaction, but it's sort of a reaction that they're trained to do.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because we're having this context within the context of our current police system. Like, what can we do to try to fix, or what things will bring us hope that there will be changes down the line? And I do think that there is a different kind of training that happens. To your point about nothing changes, you know, hopefully if there is a conviction that is a new precedent that starts to take hold as a fear. And I don't know that happens overnight, but it's true that more convictions, more oversight, more awareness of what's happening and standards that we adhere to here might help things eventually.
Maybe there will be fewer people who want to be cops.
Maybe there's
who think in that way.
But to also to that point, I mean, okay, I think that we should talk about the details of Dante's story. But Kim Cooper, the veteran police officer.
26-year vet. You're like, I'm sorry, you confused your taser and your gun. You've been doing this for 26 years?
Yeah.
That's a big number.
That's
the
a big number.
The big number, which but doesn't also, track.
Even if you're, like, if the number was 26 and it was how old she was, that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. She has been charged with second-degree manslaughter. That took about a day, and that's good, because if that hadn't happened, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah,
Minneapolis would have gone wild.
I mean, especially since this is set against the backdrop of the Derek Chauvin trial, it also leaves a bad taste in my mouth, knowing that that's probably the reason why action was taken. You know, but to your point of, you know, we've got this big high profile thing happening, and maybe that is a domino in the to give us some hope here. But yes, she had been a veteran for 26 years.
It just seems like they don't understand. Like I alluded to this. Like obviously we've talked about like cops shouldn't have guns, probably, but it doesn't seem like police officers even know what guns are. Like she didn't know it was a taser.
This one certainly doesn't.
They shoot unarmed people and say that they had guns. They just don't know what guns are. It's a problem, and I think we should take away the issue, not have them use guns, and then they won't worry about like what's a gun, what is it, because they clearly don't understand what the actual object is.
I agree with you completely. Mm-hmm. I didn't used to. I used to be like, that's ridiculous, Cody. In theory, yeah, but yeah, I'm definitely agreeing with you.
Much of the world's law enforcement, forgive me if I'm wrong, doesn't carry around guns.
It's a more complicated conversation here in America. I mean, it's a gun control and gun rights is a complicated conversation because it is a part of our Constitution. And if people have guns, then, you know, the very obvious counterpoint, at least that we've accepted, is that cops have guns to protect themselves. You know, we're not taking away all the guns. But yes, but you're right. Other countries have cracked this case, you know.
Away from guns, I also have to wonder often in these cases, if a body of color is restraining or stopping, or, you know, if a police officer is a body of color, I imagine they would be less inclined to grab their gun first. You know, and that's a sort of untaught thing that the body of color can bring to it. And so it brings up the conversation of systemic, you know, of what's coded within one body to have sort of power over another. You know, there's I know a sadly only one, you know, African-American black police officer. And, you know, he says, I have to think extra hard about the certain calls I make. Mm. About the certain decisions I make. And I'm happy to think extra hard because I know I can ruin someone's life.
Yeah.
And is everyone else on that force thinking extra hard?
You know? Absolutely not. Right. Is the answer to that.
Right. And I mean, and you're right of what are the things that we hold, or, you know, Kim Cooper, what did she, why was she so afraid of this 20-year-old kid? Why are you so afraid? Like, why are you so afraid of a 13-year-old who clearly doesn't have a gun in his hand?
Fear is a good word. And if you are that fearful of a person, you should not be an officer.
You shouldn't be an officer.
And we should figure out, if we're going to keep putting guns in their hands, we should figure out some sort of test that says, like, are you afraid of things? Are you just easily terrified? And me giving you this gun makes you think you're not terrified? Because it shouldn't be a means to put in front of your fear.
Yeah.
You should be able to be in an argument comfortably and disagree and fight and, you know, maybe use your hands if you have to, right? But that we give them this ultimate stopper, right? A gun is not meant for conversation. It's meant to stop conversation.
Yeah.
They certainly shouldn't be involved in a traffic stop, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's a conversation that I'm seeing happen online and, you know, I believe it was Oakland, we talked about this a few weeks ago, who is either already implementing or looking into and figuring out how to take away traffic violations and traffic stops from the purview of the police force.
At the very least.
And it's hard. All these little mitigating measures that don't actually address the core issue, which is oppression, systems of oppression, long held. I do want to talk about some of the details here because there is stuff to unpack even within that. Dante Wright, like I mentioned, 20 years old, was driving with his girlfriend when he was pulled over by cops in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis. He frantically calls his mom. Ooh, and this part just gets me, the fact that he's on the phone with his mom, you know, telling her he was pulled over for having air fresheners.
Please.
You get to interject whenever.
Have you seen the pattern of these young men just wanting their mothers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
George Floyd wanted his mother, who's the kid who had anemia in Colorado. Yeah. And, right, he wanted his mother.
Was that Elijah McClain?
Elijah McClain. you know, these sort of pattern of these people just needing the comfort.
The kids. Also, even if you're not a kid, yes, that situation of like you want to. I'm 36. I cry for my mom routinely. I want her, you know. But yes, exactly. So he talks to his mom. The call gets disconnected. His girlfriend calls her back a minute later to tell her that he's dead. Apparently, Dante had a warrant out for his arrest, and I want to address that.
That means it's okay.
No, that means who fucking cares if he has a warrant for his arrest? It doesn't matter what the warrant is for. Obviously, you weren't serious.
yes, but wait, their job wait a isn't. Second, Katie.
No, Cody, you're wrong, and I all disagree right, okay, with you completely. All right. But I do want to address the warrant because regardless, it doesn't matter what crime the warrant was out for, not their job to kill him. But yeah, okay, so he had two misdemeanor charges, and I've seen different accounts of what exactly transpired, but we do know that one of them was for marijuana, and I believe that the warrant was because of a failure to appear or a failure to pay a fine. Failed to pay a fine during the pandemic, which he deferred. I believe they'd sent stuff to the wrong address. So he's just a kid that probably didn't know, you know, or maybe had a fear but didn't know. But regardless, he got killed for pot. How many men have been killed? Black men have been killed for marijuana or currently incarcerated over marijuana.
Which is just as bad as, you know, because putting a young man in prison for life for marijuana to me is also, you know, like just you might as well. Like it's just to me, it's just like it's another way of killing someone. It's another way of taking them away from society.
Yeah. Removing their humanity and
yeah.
Or trying to at least.
There was another story, Marvin Scott III. This kind of got overshadowed. He died in county jail in Texas, I want to say. That happened a couple weeks ago, also recently, and barely breaking the surface of the news. Anyway, it's a lot. It's a lot, and it's heavy feeling. And it's hard to find something hopeful and productive to say right now. I guess maybe this is a good time to pivot to some of the work that you've been doing, Chris. You've done a lot of wonderful things and you've got some cool projects coming up and a lot of it deals with being a body of color, the pressures of being a body of color in entertainment in Los Angeles or even just out and about in the world. And I'd love to hear you talk about some of these projects and the stories and experiences of what brought you here and the things you're working on.
I want to use the term in this for now. I like putting this term on blast. And so this feels like a good opportunity. Resma Menicum says this beautiful thing. He says bodies of culture, not bodies of color, which I really like, you know, bodies with history. Yeah. I work in story and in telling stories. And, you know, a lot of my stories use the word pressure, right? They're the pressures of being a body of color or a body of culture. But I think what I'm more interested in currently is, sure, there's pressure, you know, but I believe one of the things I can do through my writings or my essay or, you know, like a film I make is I can allow someone else to... I don't need them to feel my pressure. I just need them to realize how in simple acts, you know, I'll take two films, for example. I have that New York Times one, the Calm Your Curls one, how simple acts like cutting your hair for some people can just be cutting your hair. And for some people, it can be years of self-hate, years of doubt whether you can even – you should have hair that curly or that thick, you know, how sometimes such a simple act as cutting your hair carries so much weight. Mm-hmm. Or this other film I made for Outside Magazine, how a simple act like running for some people is just a jog in the park. And for some people it's a jog that you have to smile through.
Yeah.
And you have to keep your head and who's around you, right? Like, something that guides my work a lot, everything I do, is James Baldwin. He says, the great plight of man is man's inability to imagine another man, to imagine his existence, to imagine his weight. And so I hope that I'm making art and telling stories that allow people to imagine another person's existence. I have a moment in, I have this show where the real James Bond was Dominican. Because yes, James Bond was based on a Dominican man.
Yeah, I will. I want to come back and have you tell us a little bit about that too. That's important. But yeah.
And I have this moment where I tell people that when I was a kid, my grandmother used to tell me to sleep with a clothespin pinched to my nose to help keep it thin. That's what they would do back in the campo. That, you know, every night you would squeeze your nose with a clothespin. And I...
Does that work?
I then... It did not work. Trust me.
It doesn't work, right?
Trust me. It didn't work. And then I tell the audience, we hide clothespins under their chairs. And so everyone takes out a clothespin.
Okay.
You know? There's a lot of awkward giggles and like, ha, ha, ha. And yeah. You'd also be surprised how many people were told the same thing. And then I ask people to put it on. You know, we share that moment together. And that's it. I move on with the show. We take it off. We go forward. They get to keep it as a souvenir if they want. And after the show, we do a talk back. And before the pandemic, this was the last time I did it live before I'm heading to New York right now. And this man, 6-year-old white man, said, "I'm really sorry, but I zoned out for the rest of the show after the clothespin moment. Because for the first time in my life, I could actually understand that I never had to think about my body."
Oh.
You know, so he says, I missed the remainder of your show.
Because he was thinking about that.
He was feeling it. He wasn't thinking about it. He was feeling it. We can think all we want. But until we feel it, it doesn't change.
Yeah.
We can think all we want. We can talk about systemic stuff. We can talk about it. We can talk, but like, and this is why it takes time. And this is why it challenges hope. People have to feel it.
Yeah.
Someone has to not be afraid of a young black man. They have to feel it. Someone has to not be afraid of a young black man. Someone has to not be afraid of a large black man with a fake $20 bill. They just have to not be afraid. They have to feel it. Oh, this is a person. Like, I'm a person.
To recognize the humanity in another person like themselves, to understand that we are not different. Our circumstances, society, all of these things have made us think that we're different. Do you find that you're reaching a lot of people? That's one story. Do you have you had similar experiences in taking this work around?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of stories like that. You know, one I tell, this is with not a white body, but a young Pakistani kid, you know, in New York, Pace student. And same play, real James Bond was Dominican. He said, after the show, he said, "My whole life I thought I needed heroes and superheroes who look like me, but I just needed regular people telling their story." And I think that's extremely, like, I think, you know, I'm really passionate about media and proper representation, you know, responsible representation, as I like to call it, like societal responsibility that we represent what colors and shapes and people actually look like in the world, because then it's possible, you know, if we keep it in this conversation of, you know, a white officer being afraid, if white officer was more like, had more images of when Harry met Sally's who happened to be brown and black, white officer might just see that person as a Harry met Sally, not as a villain.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a big part of this, our cultural representations for sure. And the fact that our current media landscape, although better, I guess, than in the past, does not, like you said, accurately represent our anything globally, but especially here in America, who we are and how diverse we are. You know, Chris is also an actor, so he has lots of experience auditioning in LA, and I'm sure you've had your share of white actors complaining about
being white. Yeah. Like how hard it is to be white right now. Yeah. That's exactly what I want to hear.
It's so fucking frustrating. I had a conversation with somebody, a white actor, who was like, "Well, the truth is that there's just more white actors Like there's less black people competing for a role versus there are white people competing for the roles. So it's hard and it's frustrating. There should be more roles because there's more. And I was like, ooh, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm going to stop you right there. Oh, are there too many white actors? Is it because you grew up feeling entitled that like you should be on TV because you saw lots of white people on TV and you're like, yes, I can do it. So like, how come there aren't more black actors? We'll just go with that. How come? Is it because that there aren't a lot of opportunities and they haven't been raised to believe that they have a place in the media landscape? You know, the conversations like that. I just get really frustrated.
How did he absorb that?
You're just like, well, yeah. Fair, you know, didn't want to confront that. But I want to hear a little bit about how James Bond was Dominican, because you told me about this before, and I thought it was very cool.
Yeah, his name was Porfirio Rubirosa. He was twice the richest man in the world when he was married to Barbara Hutton and Doris Duke. Those are two of his five marriages.
Was he married to them at the same time?
No, separate times. But very short, brief times. But yep. And he was a Dominican diplomat. He was stationed all over the world. He was stationed in Hitler's Germany, where he smuggled thousands of the Jews out of Germany into the DR by selling them like fake Dominican visas, and stationed in Castro's Cuba during the revolution, and smuggled guns from Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, and the New York City mob, best friends with Sinatra and Kennedy and the whole Rat Pack, and just this kind of also best friends with Ian Fleming. You know, would spend months together at Ian Fleming's Golden Eye Estate and at casinos in Monte Carlo. And, you know, Ian Fleming is on record saying, I based the character of James Bond on this man. And I read this Vanity Fair article that said this, and I was... my world was shattered, and I wondered, why isn't everyone as obsessed with this as me? Like, how did this article not go viral? Like, what am I missing? Like, why is this not the biggest news topic in the world? And that was the first time in my life I asked the question, like, because I grew up, I'm a huge James Bond fan, and, you know, I wondered, how would my life have been different if the character I love most looked like me or looked like my father? Mm-hmm. You know, if I wasn't running around in my tidy whities with my Nerf gun, you know, putting on a fake British accent.
Yep.
Like what would I have thought about myself?
Right. How would you have seen yourself in the world or seen what you could be or what could happen? You mentioned that you are heading back to New York to do this again.
Yeah. I'm headed back to Rochester to a theater called Jiva. And there will not be people in the audience, which I have feelings about, you know.
Yeah.
And we're going to be doing a recorded version. We're not recording the live show because I refuse to do that. We are creating a version that's shot on their stage for four cameras. It's very specifically created for that. And people can watch it. It's going to run on like their theater schedule 8 nights a week.
Will you send people nose clips? Mm-hmm. Okay.
We are. Yeah, we're sending them. When you buy a ticket, you get a package with some fun stuff, you know, cocktail recipes, some fun facts about the DR, some clothespins.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, love that. I love that. Mm-hmm. I bring this up because, like I mentioned, Chris and I have been, I bring it up for lots of reasons because I think people should see this, but also because you had been working so hard on this for a really long time. And I'm going to bring it back around to the pandemic because things were really picking up for you and then the pandemic hit. And I know that that is an experience that so many people can relate to, you know, getting traction, getting things started. And then what that experience has been like to then have it, you know, as an artist. We haven't talked to that many artists on this show, actually, about what this has been like and how it has affected your art and what, you know, what's come up for you.
Yeah, you know, I published an essay that maybe people can read on Zocalo, and it talks about how Aretha Franklin, you know, taught me to grieve.
I missed this one.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. Watching Amazing Grace, the documentary, which everyone should watch, is an Aretha Franklin documentary of her recording the album live in a church, Amazing Grace. And that documentary just kind of shattered me, and I realized as you said, I lost a lot. Like I lost work, I lost finances.
He had some stuff going on. Like
and I fell so hard. Yeah. But in the falling so hard and in the sadness, I never made space to grieve. I was so obsessed with like, mm-hmm. all right, get it together, like get right, do your thing. And I think artist or no artist, it's important that we make space to grieve.
Yeah.
I think that's true in the news cycle. I think that's true in the climate crisis, which I'm really passionate about. I think it's true in every major issue. Before we solve it, we must grieve with it. We must feel it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as like, don't think about white supremacy. Feel it. You know, and so I learned how to grieve, you know, and I learned what really mattered. My value system changed, you know. The kind of stories I want to tell changed. Like I always wanted to tell stories like I'm telling, you know, but now I'm like, I don't really have time for anything else.
Like, well, it feels like there's more of there's a purpose.
Yeah.
Behind it, there is a focus of what I can do.
Clarity.
A crystallized vision. I mean, you've been working on getting to there your whole career, but like, you know, from my perspective, it feels like that happened for you, for a lot of people, but for you.
You know, I'm excited for what is going to, because I don't even know what's going to be birthed of it. Like, it's still kind of so fresh because we're still sort of in it, right? Just got vaccinated. You know. But crystallized is a great word, and found a new level of my voice, I think, as a writer, which I'm really excited about. I think I told you about the book coming out. And
But tell everybody listening, because this is cool.
Yeah, it's called Brown Enough, and it's about it's a memoir / collection of essays about what brownness means in America in different shades, you know, like brownness in the American dream, brownness in toxic masculinity, brownness in Hollywood, brownness in dating, just examining, you know, what is brownness's role in America, told through some experiences I've had.
I can't wait for this. I know you've been percolating on this for a while, and then also a podcast to go along with it, perhaps.
Same title, Brown Enough, and just sort of having conversations and meeting my own biases, right? Like when I was first thinking about that podcast, you know, I was like, oh, I need another brown host. And that's obviously a Latin person. And my friend was like, why don't you like take my Indian friend? I was like, oh, damn, I totally forgot. Brownness is so much more. Like we fall into our own biases and our own smallness and our own, you know, it's everything.
I think that's an important thing to bring up and note. White people, if somebody calls you out, you can just say, oh, yes, you're right. I didn't think of it like that. All of us can. So when can we expect to see James Bond and buy tickets so we can get our care packages and watch the magic happen?
You can buy tickets now at Jiva Theater.
Great.
Get your care packages sent to you. The book will be a while. It's September 2022.
We'll have you back then.
Yeah. So the book will be a while, and then the podcast will be around the corner too. Yeah. So it's all really exciting things, and hopefully it just allows people to feel it, not just to think about it, not just to think about difference, but to feel difference and to grieve with it.
I'm so glad you bring up grieving, because we've talked about that a lot here. But you say it so well, and it's true. There's so much. We're surrounded by our grief right now, all of us, living in it, swimming through it, and it has brought everything up. And I feel stronger. I still feel like I'm reeling from everything, but I know that I am stronger, and I know that I have a bit more of a roadmap for navigating times like these and grief. It is. And you brought up climate grief. We could talk about all of this stuff for a long time, but.
Well, the climate stuff is, we've had the conversations about the climate stuff. I'm just, that's one where you have to grieve because it's so big,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Tell people what climate grief is in case they might not be familiar.
Well, I steal the term from someone named Joanna Macy, who's she's an ecologist, a systems theorist, and a Buddhist monk.
Love that.
That's a business great card. Combo. and a great writer. And Joanna Macy, you know, that's her whole thing. She travels the world, you know, in hopes of saving the planet, but first grieving with it, you know, first feeling it, first feeling its losses, first feeling its pain. And then you go from there, right?
The damage that's already been done.
But yeah. You have to feel it before you are ready to take action, to be ready to address what's happening.
Yeah. She says, you know, if you can't feel the pain of the world, you'll be banished from its joys as well. And that's a quote I like.
I had somebody bring, this is a bit of a pivot, but I actually want to hear your thoughts on this. I had somebody, they were railing against online outrage culture. So I'm not sure, but he made this point of that saying, if you're not outraged, you're doing it wrong or whatever.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he was like, but what's so interesting is that, like with meditation and, you know, you're seeking to not be reactive, to not get to a reactive place. And I thought that was an interesting point. I don't think that it can apply. It can apply in that I think you need to be outraged to know that something's wrong. I think you need to feel it, feel the grief, and then be resolute with how you're going to proceed. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Uh-huh. 100%.
Well, you're taking the energy of outrage and the clarity of knowing that there's injustice, but you have the clarity.
Right. So I don't think I don't love using that as an argument against people being upset about stuff. But I do think that there is something to, don't, you know, use this, take that and use it. And
yeah, there's a channeling of that energy that isn't just like, I'm angry. It's like, well, okay, that's good. That's a good first step to know that there's something to be angry about. But
I have a meditation teacher who says something I love, which is let the heat kill you. And you know, if you're hot, be hot. If you're cold, be cold. If you're angry, be angry. And now watch it flow. Like if you're sad,
I love
be
that.
Sad. Because we're constantly trying to get to the next step. You know, to the solution step. You know, if you're confused, be confused. Mm. If you're burdened, be burdened. Let the heat kill you. It will turn into something else.
And it all means something. What you're experiencing in your body is meant to point you in the direction of something. You're angry about something. Well, sit with that. What is that? What's at the root here? You know,
what you just said made me think of just this, how powerful this summer was, and watching the world march.
Yeah.
Talk about movement. That's what I'm more interested in, is like, I want to tell stories that not just touch people, but could they create movement?
And sustained movement.
You know, a sustained movement. And that's hard these days where, you know, we can hit the like button and the share button for a month strong, but, you know, come month and a half, we're good. You know, back to taking pictures of our food. Like,
it's hard.
Sustained movement.
I mean, you and I have talked about this a lot in the past, and the frustration and the hope, the power of seeing people move and be, you know, take to the streets and to stand up, and the despair of seeing that also go away, you know, and how do we sustain this? How do we keep this going? You know, I don't have an answer.
I don't have an answer.
Some days,
Cody, you got an answer?
No, can't.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a great positive place to leave it.
Sitting with there is no answer.
Sitting with it, but being present. Chris, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate it. And it is a sad time, or it is the time. It is whatever it is. It's the season of these things happening. And it's important to be talking about it, you know, and feeling it and putting it on blast.
Put it on blast. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate you showing up and taking the time to chat with us. Can you just one more time plug the things that you have coming up and where people can find you? You're not a Twitter guy, right?
I'm not a Twitter guy.
Good for you.
I'm an Instagram person. Yeah. Thank you.
He's great at Instagram. That's a solid Insta follow. Lots of nuggets of wisdom.
Yep. Just some wisdom is what Katie says. I don't know if it's wisdom on my end, but
for me it is.
I'm on the Insta. I got a website where we you can see a lot of my work I do with like refugees and just different communities of disenfranchised that I like to do storytelling with, and some of my workshop work. And
do you have some of your stories on there too?
Oh yeah, I got a ton of stories on there.
I met Chris when I took his storytelling workshop, and it was a really incredible experience. And your ability to draw stuff out of people, make them feel comfortable and find their own voice is really special.
Thank you. I believe in that. I believe in spaces where people can share their story.
Yeah.
Like creating those spaces. Like that's something I believe in. Yeah. So the website, you can see some stories. You can tell some stories with me. You can share some stories. You can read my work online. I think if you just sort of Google it, you'll find some, have a couple of things in the Times and, that Zocalo essay on grief, some other writings around there. Yeah. I have a film coming out in Outsider Magazine, but I'll get you all that.
Yeah. We'll definitely be sharing that. This new film, as well as one that you did, I believe, last year for the New York Times. You ended up collaborating with our friend and Somewhere News director, Will Gord, to make both of them. And Will is incredible. He keeps our ship running. Just a really cool guy. And so we'll definitely be sharing that. Both of those pieces are really beautiful, and you guys should check them out.
And if you want to see the play, Jiva Theater, it's in Rochester. Check it out. Get some tickets, and it's really good.
I'm going to do it today. All right, guys, that does it for us. Take care of yourself. Keep showing up. And remember that we love you very much. Very much.